You're listening to Classic Dialogues, Land Power in the Indo-Pacific, a China Land Power Study Center production. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. I'm in the studio today with Colonel Richard Butler, director of the China Land Power Study Center at the U.S. Army War College, and Army Colonel, Assistant Chief of Staff, G5, U.S. Army Pacific, Marco Lyons. Over to you, Colonel Butler.
So with Marco here, this is the first in a series of podcasts that have grown from a collaboration among a few classic affiliates and experts seeking to understand the character of war against a peer adversary and the implications for the PRC, the U.S., and its allies as part of our themed research leading up to our next Carlisle conference on the PLA this October. Marco, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
How does the Pacific Army see, understand, and realize land power in the region across the competition continuum?
The Pacific Army sees land power as sorely misunderstood, and we see land power as the linchpin, as the Secretary has said, to operations, especially in combined joint operations against our primary threats. Land power will be realized through extending posture into the Western Pacific, extending posture out of the Northeastern Asia region. It will be realized through dedicated modernization efforts in theater in the most realistic scenarios that we can put together. It will be realized through our relationships and training with allies and partners in the region.
Can we talk a little bit about how the Pacific Army conducts campaigning, prepares for crisis, deters conflict, and if necessary, prevail in conflict? Because that's very unique to the region. I'd say from the standpoint of an Army perspective, focusing on the Middle East and Europe for much of the last several decades, both for the Soviet threat and the wars in the Middle East over the last 20 years. But we began the Pacific pivot back in 2011. And for Army folks, it's difficult to understand the differences that exist out in that region. Can you elucidate a little bit on that?
Yes, of course, it's difficult for Army. And frankly, it's difficult for the rest of the joint force to fully understand the military implications of the region. As we do like to say, most of continental Europe fits inside of the South China Sea. So I'm constantly reminding people, I'm constantly reminding planners and commentators that when you compare Europe to the Indo-Pacific, the maps we use are often of a very, very different scale, about 1 to 3. So we are used to seeing a Europe map that is already 3 times larger as compared to the Indo-Pacific. This is really, really significant because the operational geometry is vastly different in the Indo-Pacific. Directly, it is vastly larger in scale. It's also, frankly, more complex when you add by far the largest archipelagic terrain on the surface of the Earth is in this region. Also, I will say most of the land area between Japan and Australia, exclusive, when you add it all up, is equal to the continental United States west of the Mississippi. I offer this to give people a mental picture that when you put all the land area between Japan and Australia together, so you can see it as one land mass, that is a very, very large area, Mississippi all the way to the Pacific coast. As General Flynn likes to say, there's a lot of land in the Indo-Pacific. I also remind people, yes, China is part of the AOR. And China, of course, is a huge country by land mass as well. Plus, there's India. The Indo-Pacific is just very large. There's a lot of water. There's a lot of air. There's a lot of space. And there's a lot of land.
How does that play into how you plan campaigning events for the Army and tie that to the joint force as well as our allies and partners?
I'll start, first of all, with something that has been becoming more and more evident to, I think, leaders and planners in the Indo-Pacific over the last 10 to 15 years. And that is the return of the operational level of war in a real sense as a true level of war. The return of the operational level of war means to us out in the Indo-Pacific that when we're thinking about campaigning, when we're thinking about gaining and maintaining military advantage over potential adversaries, we are always thinking in terms of multiple operations and even multiple campaigns. This is a level of military thinking and certainly a level of military planning that we're not used to and really needs to be brought back from history, brought back from generations past.
That's great. I think I've heard you use the term, it's almost a renaissance in planning from how we think things. And I know being historic minded, you look back at how we prepared for World War II globally, but specifically in the Indo-Pacific, and things that we've done since we pulled out of Vietnam and how we have to reshape the geographic regions. One of those aspects is how we're approaching modernization. A lot of work's been done by Army Future Command and other Army commands to start reinvigorating modernization in the Army and then pushing it out into places like the Indo-Pacific where it can be used for campaigning. How does USARPAC, U.S. Army Pacific, approach modernization of the new formations like the Multi-Domain Task Forces and the Security Force Assistance Brigade?
The central point, of course, is that modernization needs to take place out in theater and, frankly, as far west as we can get it. And there are options. In planning terms, we can look to the Philippines, Indonesia, Australia, and some other options for getting ground that we can actually conduct modernization on. So the first thing is get modernization out into the theater. The equipment and the capabilities and the concepts need to be developed in the operational environment that we need to plan for and that we will operate in. So the first point is we see modernization needing to take place out in theater. Along with that, put modernization into the hands of commanders. I know the Army already prioritizes this, and that's important, but I'm thinking here about commanders who are in the Pacific Army, in the Pacific Theater Army, out in the region, preferably in the potential areas of operation that they would be operating in conflict. And so let commanders with their formations get their hands on, so to speak, the modernization, the modernized capabilities that we believe we need, and let them experiment and maneuver and exercise over time on the ground, and then basically feed that understanding back to the Army and back to the modernization enterprise. So first, we need to prioritize getting that into the theater, get it into a chain of command that corresponds to a warfighting organization, and then get those lessons back to the Army as quickly as possible.
Fires in the MDTF is one thing we focus on, both kinetic and non-kinetic, because that provides some early advantages inside the first island chain and helps the joint force become very solid and linked with allies and partners. And the SFAB is a permanently engaged organization that's working with multiple allies and partners to help fill some seams and build a more robust integrated defense or deterrent effect. But armies also exist, and land forces in general, strategic land power. So we talk Army and we talk Marines, we talk about soft on the ground, that they have to seize key and decisive terrain, that it's not just about fires, that there's maneuver. Maneuver has to be tied to fires. Maneuver has to be tied to logistics, has to be tied to C2. We tend to focus on some of the newness of the renaissance in fires, but in reality, it's the transcendence of all the warfighting functions coming fully into the 21st century and operating at the speed of conflict that I think you're alluding to, which sometimes we overlook. Any follow-up comments on that thought?
The ascendancy and the supremacy of fires, I would ask that we also look at that in terms of the belief in short, sharp wars. If you start with a premise that we have the ability and we have the capacity to win short, sharp wars, and we prioritize, as we have, fires for at least a couple decades, and I'm talking about the whole joint force prioritizing fires, then that makes sense if it's a short, sharp war. I think it's fair to say short, sharp wars might be desirable in a general policy sense. We need to prepare for the exact opposite. We need to prepare for protracted conflicts. And in protracted conflicts, of course, fires needs to be brought back into the balance of the warfighting functions. And yes, and balancing warfighting functions in this theater, given the geographic scale and given the character of the operational environment, complex, very complex. This, again, is bringing the warfighting functions back together, back in balance, and bringing it up to the operational level. I would even say we're talking about operational maneuver, which is distinct from tactical maneuver. We're talking about operational fires, which is distinct from tactical fires, and so forth. So they're all at the operational level. Okay, now I would be remiss if I didn't bring General Flynn back into this. No priority national policy aims will be achieved without forces on the ground. And those are forces that are designed, trained, and led for ground operations, land power. And so we at United States Army Pacific, we have never-ending day-in, day-out mission to make sure that we are ready to bring that land power. I would remind people, we need to be ready to bring land power to what are in fact very large areas of ground. Again, going back to the mismatch in scales between Europe and the Indo-Pacific. Luzon is an island, but Luzon is a very, very large island. Luzon's the size of a small country in and of itself.
You brought the Philippines in. How does USURPAC plan for allies and key security partners across that continuum of conflict?
Well, I will start with the news headlines. Nobody should have missed, for the last few years, headline after headline after headline, really building momentum towards historic national security changes for Japan and the Philippines and Australia and Vietnam and India and ROC, Republic of Korea. So nobody should miss a near tidal wave of historic changes happening there right away. Even before that, to return back to the word renaissance, I think there's some important and very valuable newer thinking in how we think about allies and partners. I'll say we need true partners, broader, deeper relations with our partners in the region to support our policy aims. And I would say that we need that to a degree that really is a generational change. So specifically, we are at United States Army Pacific, we are thinking about multinational, multi-domain formations with the Japanese and Australians, for example, and that could be extended to other nationalities. In planning terms, we're thinking about the need for cooperative stores of equipment, ammunition. We're thinking about the need for cooperative arrangements for the use of munitions. We're thinking about cooperative arrangements for the manning and equipping of formations in theater. We're thinking about all of these newer approaches to get to filling out land power options as far forward in theater as we can get. And so that's all the way to the Western Pacific, which, again, I'm glad we haven't talked about the tyranny of distance yet, because that's a cliche. And the tyranny of distance can sometimes be a showstopper in conversations, but the operational environment is the operational environment, and we need to accept it as it is and plan for it. But allies and partners are a very distinct part of our operational environment. We also haven't brought up yet, but of course, it's a reality that there is nothing NATO-like in the region. But nonetheless, we will work with the operational environment as we face it. And there are challenges that are more complex than Europe and the Middle East.
First of all, your thought on the concept of tyranny of distance as a conversation ender ought to be a conversation beginner, because it's clearly a potential large-scale gap in a long war or long conflict. If you look at the amount of air transport and sea transport required to lift formations from all the services, but particularly the Marines and the Army, when you need to have and control key and decisive terrain in places you are not, or need to thicken those lines from thin line. Clearly, we need to have some of those discussions. That's why the Army talks about logistics and contested logistics, and that's now in the joint force. The question is, are we really having the right discussion when it comes to joint force design and how we're spending taxpayer money to protect the vital interests of the American population? And again, our defense industrial base has changed. So it's not really just our defense industrial base. It's the thickened lines of the adversaries and what they can do. Now, the other thing that struck me is when it comes to multinational, we know a little bit about this in Northeast Asia already, particularly in the Republic of Korea and our bilateral defense agreement that's now thickening into a trilateral with the Japanese out of necessity, not because it's the nice thing to do. We know there's historic legacy issues there between populations. It's a 360-degree threat from the authoritarian nations that's starting to drive how relationships in Northeast Asia thicken and how they look externally to support defense as well. There's a multilateral relationship that the alliance is starting to rejigger and figure out how it plays in more defense in terms of the United Nations command and the UN sending states that have promised to come back if war erupts on the peninsula again. We can learn a lot, I think, about that and how you thicken those lines, both in new formations, things related to the Quad. Just look at how Talisman Sabre and Super Gruta Shield have blown up as really high-end joint exercises the last several years. And already in Northeast Asia, where you have to be the strongest to make sure that you don't lose early. I think it's just fascinating. But I want to go back to C2 a little bit. Those who are fans of military decision-making processes or joint operational planning process, because what would we have if we didn't have a process written in a book? We do C2 alignment last. And over the last several years, I've heard General Flynn and you and other proponents of strategy and planning and policy think, like, maybe that's backwards. maybe we got to start thinking about what C2 is set right now because of how we have to maintain those alliances and partnerships and thicken those lines and integration. Well, after the year and a half in the job now, where are you at in that thought of what's C2 got to look like or should look like and things we should be thinking about in the Indo-Pacific region where you have to be strong all the time?
First of all, General Flynn would probably say, and certainly his actions and words demonstrate, that C2 is probably the center pole in the tent, critical. It needs to be done right. And by the way, to go back to looking at historical examples, getting C2 wrong before war costs a lot of lives in lost battles and lost early operations. I would say if we get C2 wrong, we could truly suffer as a nation for up to a year. To put a timeline on it, it could take up to a year for us to correct the wrong C2 in war if we don't get it right before the start of war. So getting C2 right today, and we are in campaigning. We're not on the eve of armed conflict for sure, but we need to get C2 right today because of all the trends pointing towards armed conflict. So C2, absolutely the center pole. Now, with respect to C2, and we've talked about even the operational environment and the extended lines of operation and modernization, we know a lot of the problems, although we need to do a lot more experimentation and wargaming to identify those even better and identify the requirements that we don't yet understand. The first answer to all those problems is leadership. It is humans. As much as I do talk about needed modernization capabilities material, it actually starts with leaders who have the right ideas and who are in C2 arrangements that allow them to extend their leadership vision to these large formations. And that, of course, is the part that links to operational art and into the first operation and the first campaign of the next war.
You've mentioned a lot of that you're concerned about the operational level of war, that it's back with a vengeance, right?
It's back with a vengeance.
The C2 structure problems you see, where is it most prolifically a problem? Is it at the tactical end, the operational end, or the theater strategic end?
Organizations and tactical leadership and tactical formations and tactical C2 arrangements, the dire problems are not at the tactical level. I would say at the operational level, it is functionally or effectively non-existent. At the theater strategic level, there are serious problems. Now, instead of a blanket statement of the theater strategic level having serious C2 problems, I will frame that as we're not applying the historical lessons there at the theater strategic level. So, for example, and again, this is a large topic and it's kind of hard to wade into it, but let's just start with a warfighting headquarters. Again, this is back to the future, the idea of a warfighting headquarters for this theater. First point, back to the operational environment and the scale and the scope. No other region on the face of the earth needs an existing warfighting headquarters for C2 more than this region. This region, almost by definition, because of all of its characteristics, needs some type of existing, standing, to use the word, warfighting headquarters, certainly a warfighting headquarters capability. Again, this is back to the future here. In order to get there, among other things, we need to break through some mental blockage. One, with some type of standing warfighting headquarters capability, so I'm framing it very specifically there, would it be provocative and would it contribute to escalation? We need to break through this thinking. And by the way, here I'm just going to pause and say we need to bring in all the best Chinese regional expertise that we have. There is an incredible growing generation, I hate to use the word, but generation of scholars from Hal Brands to Sheena Greitens who we can pull in to understand this space a lot better. Because I believe that when we look into this, our thinking about how volatile escalation could be in this region between China and the United States, and even how unpredictable escalation would be in this case, I think that we would break through to some truly new thinking. And it's not what we think before. It's not as unpredictable and it's not as dramatic as we once thought.
The challenges of how many warfighting operational level commands do you need? Where do they need to be? You have to tie them to your warfighting concepts and how you would see a fight going down. Going back to your point, is it a sharp, sharp fight or is it going to be something longer, which is the more traditional view of large-scale peer-on-peer conflict? And as you said, it plays into how you deter and how you assure. Being tied tighter with your allies and partners is a part of that and how you intend to fight that conflict and how you break up the regions. Indo-Pacific Command is responsible for 51% of the Earth's surface and 36 nations and Taiwan. So that's a lot. And if you go back to World War II, we did divide the theater. There were essentially two combatant commands. Could have been three even, I suspect, if we chose to really do the northern route, which we backed away from. Really, you need to start thinking about that because you have to deal with that strategic maneuver, the defense in depth. You have to deal with the forward projection into the operational area, the forward line of contact or the FIBA. And then the fires areas is deeper and deeper as we go deeper into the 21st century. So how you divvy up the battle space and your battle space geometry and manage that, even with AI-enabled planning and execution, could completely overwhelm a single command. And I think those are really important things to sort of look at. Marco, let me give the final word to you as we finish.
The final word in terms of just protracted war with China. It is true there's nothing inevitable about this, about a conflict with China. And there's also nothing inevitable that we'd go to war with China that is protracted. To go in reverse order there, unfortunately, all of my study of history tells me when great powers go to war, it is almost always protracted. And there are internal structural reasons for that. And those are internal structural reasons that I don't believe China and the United States are going to be able to somehow overcome. Unfortunately, if we go to war with China, we should be prepared for a protracted conflict. Conflict is absolutely not inevitable. And I would say, look no further than the individuals who are on the strategic stage, Xi Jinping and our own national leadership, decisions that have been made over the last two decades. So I would say, again, my study of both deeper history and more recent history, leaders are perceiving the world, they're perceiving the world through their own experiences. So Xi Jinping has a very specific background and mental frame that anybody can look into, and Americans should look into that. But Xi Jinping can choose a different path, is what I'm saying, and our leaders have options. So that's all higher than my level. But as General Flynn says, we have got to be prepared to provide the best possible military options. And when we do that, we'll be in the best possible position to face possible armed conflict.
All right, Marco, thanks for that and appreciate you being here.
For more Army War College podcasts, check out Decisive Point, Conversations on Strategy, and SSI Live.